from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. We're here to help people live a longer, healthier life. Indeed, when we're talking about our way of rejuvenating, I have brand new information about reversing cell aging. Let me put this in proper perspective. We are now looking at how we can literally slow down the aging process and reverse much of its damage. For example, if you have that crepey skin that frequently shows up in people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s around your knees, under your arms, your neck, non-surgically, that can be completely reversed based upon how they can rejuvenate platelets using your own blood and separating them off. So in effect, you're recreating new collagen with these immature new stem cells. We can reverse brain aging. We can grow new dendrites. We can enhance mitochondrial energy. So there is reason to be optimistic that you are not going to just age as everyone else normally does, getting slower and weaker and your body becoming more susceptible to diseases and frailties, that you can reinvigorate. On an upcoming program, I'll do an hour special on the state of the art of everything that actual science, all good peer-reviewed science, shows we can do. So that's coming at you shortly. Today, we're going to talk about some of these things, and then my guest in the second part of our program will be from Washington, D.C., Robert Perry. Robert is one of our leading progressive investigative journalists. By the way, he was the one who uncovered the Iran-Contra story. He also uncovered Oliver North's involvement, which earned him a George Polk Award for national reporting in 1984. He is also currently the senior editor and writes for Consortium News. We're going to talk about the new McCarthyism and the effects to launch a new Cold War with Russia. The trouble is this time, the new McCarthyism is not about the fascists that we saw in 1946-47 after Winston Churchill went to Virginia, gave a speech talking about the Iron Curtain, and then suddenly the Hollywood witch hunts, and then the Hollywood Ten. I'll tell you more about them later. And then after that became Joe McCarthy's time and McCarthyism. That was all mainly your conservative and pro-fascistic group. Today, it's many of the liberal community who are engaged in it, and certainly the corporate Democrats. So we need to expose this. Also today, got a lot of good feedback. People appreciated the insights into that we have runaway planet and heat. It's increasing. Glaciers are melting. The Arctic is melting. Greenland is melting. Antarctica is melting. Major drought in 20 states in the United States. Not going to relent. And so we contribute to this, but when you look at what we actually do specifically and personally to contribute to it, then it gets our attention. And in that moment, we can stop and say, I can change that. I don't have to eat meat. I can eat vegetables and grains and beans and nuts and seeds. So there's a lot we can do. So part two today, and this one is very good. It's entitled The Trap of Consumerism. Now, the whole film, which can be watched on our site, is 36 minutes and 38 seconds long. We'll play about half that. And if time permits, you'll have a chance to call in at the end of the show and address your solutions for consumerism. We know the problems. I'm only interested in solutions. That's what we're up to. Let's take it on. A good study from the University of Exeter talks about how old human cells rejuvenated in breakthrough discovery on aging with resveratrol. Resveratrol, E-R-S-A-T-R-O-L, resveratrol. Now, you get resveratrol if you eat grapes, seeded grapes. You're getting it in the seed, the skin, not a whole lot in the flesh, but it's really good. You do get some if you drink wine, but you get a lot more if you drink grape juice, and you get a lot more than that if you drink grape concentrate, a lot more than that if you have grapes. Ideally, you'd eat organic, locally grown grapes. A team led by Professor Harries, Professor Molecular Genetics at the university, has discovered a new way to rejuvenate inactive senescent cells. Within hours of treatment, the older cells started to divide and had longer telomeres. Now, you've heard me many times mention that as the telomeres shorten, your life shortens. When you eat a bad diet, when you're stressed, when you're not exercising, when you're in a toxic environment, when you're around electromagnetic pulses, you shorten. When you're exercising, when you're relaxing, when you're eating right, they lengthen. So we have to do all we can to preserve the telomeres, which are the protein end caps of chromosomes, to keep those chromosomes from unraveling. So the chromosomes shorten with age, and we want to lengthen them with age. So this discovery builds on earlier findings that I've discussed that showed that a class of genes called splicing factors are progressively switching off as we age. And the university research team, working with different professors from University of Brighton and other places, found that splicing factors can be switched back on with chemicals, making senescent cells that were otherwise going to die, senescent is at the end of life, not only look physically younger, but start to believe and behave more like young cells and start dividing again. That is phenomenal information. The researchers applied compounds called resveratrol analogs. Now, mind you, the resveratrol are the substances naturally found in dark chocolate. That's good. Red grapes, blueberries also, to cell cultures. And this caused splicing factors, which are progressively switched off as we age, to be switched back on again. We're not talking about months, we're talking about hours. Hours. The cells looked younger and started to rejuvenate, behaving like young cells and dividing. And the research, small molecular modulation of splicing factors expressed in association with rescue from cellular senescence, that's the title of the article, was published in the current British Medical Journal of Cell Biology. So, here's the takeaway message. Some wonderful research has shown that when you're eating dark chocolate, no more than 2 ounces at a time, blueberries, grapes, you are getting resveratrol. That in turn is turning back on this splicing element and allows your cells to go back to work, get younger almost immediately. Now imagine if you're taking blueberries or resveratrol daily. You can also take it as a supplement. Resveratrols, there are over 5,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature on how it impacts us, but it's really right up there with some of the best of the anti-aging nutrients. Also, if you have a child or know someone who has a child with autism, according to the University of Bergen, which is in Norway, they should be listening to music, because music therapy can contribute to positive outcome for children with autism. So it might not surprise that good relationships create good outcomes. Bad relationships, we know the outcome. As meaningful relation experiences are crucial to all of us in our everyday life. However, the development of a relationship with a child with autism may be disruptive due to the level of symptoms interfering with the typical development of emotional and social abilities. In this study, researchers from the university could show that the quality of the therapeutic relationship predicts generalized changes in social skills in children diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. And it was all about listening to music, relaxing music, soothing music. And they talk about what they call the attunement as mechanism of change. Attunement processes between humans are particularly described for early interactions between infants and their caregivers. and it's been suggested that the caregiver's capability to attune and synchronize to the infant's movements and rhythms and affects, influences attachment and the development of social understanding. So within these attuned musical exchanges, the infant experiences being experienced and understood emotionally. How can I put this? In music therapy with children with autism, therapists try to transfer principles from early interaction processes by making music that is specifically tailored to the child's sounds and movements and postures and effects. And this should allow for movements of synchronization and attunement. So that's something that can help us. Remember, when a child's in the womb, every heartbeat, everything that it's doing is in perfect alignment and synchronized with the mother. And that's why we love being cuddled. We love being held. We love holding hands. If, of course, our mother would sing to us when we were in the womb and developing. If she massaged her belly as she thought about us developing, that's all positive vibrational energies. I can't do it yet, but in the very near future, I'll be coming back to New York for a period of time to premiere a new feature film that we're just now finishing. In fact, just this week, we're doing what is called sound and image correction, meaning so every frame looks the same as far as its color and its the lighting. There's a whole lot of technical aspects in finishing a film, other than filming it and then editing it in post-production, and you got to lay in your music and your bottom thirds. But you end up having a film that harmonizes a message. And part of what I've seen is a lot of films I watch, feature films and documentaries, they lack harmonization. They're just a lot of pieces put together without really considering its impact upon an audience, everything from comedies to horror films. Well, documentaries are no different. But what I also know is that when you can harmonize your intent, your joy, your mindfulness with another human being, that's when perfect synchronization occurs. That's when we feel that really good vibration. How many times have you said, I didn't get the right vibes from that person? Or that person had negative vibes? Or that person had great vibes? Well, there is a reason for that. And now there is a science to break down the vibration to frequencies. Every thought we have has a frequency. When we're angry, that's a certain frequency. When we're feeling passion and love, that's a frequency. When we're trying to heal, we definitely have a frequency. When there's a disease process in the body, a virus, a bacteria, there is a frequency. And the new science is to match a healing frequency with a disease frequency, and that stops the disease frequency. This isn't theoretical, by the way. This is actual. This is the future of medicine. Now, pharmaceutical industry is going to be against this and try to destroy it, and they'll use all their dirty tactics and their control over the FDA. But this is being done now, where you match harmonized frequencies and you get a phenomenal outcome. And I mean, it's instantaneous. So there's going to be some interesting health support group that I'll be doing with some clinicians in New York, matching frequencies, healing frequencies to disease frequencies to see improve this in a double-blind study. This has never been done before, ever, anywhere. But I'm very confident based upon what I've seen up to this point that this is the future and this can happen. But without any of this equipment and without doing it clinically, every single person that looks in someone's eyes and you're holding that person, you're hugging that person, you're harmonizing right there. You're both on the same frequency. It's when we get out of frequency that we have the problem, because then we know it. How many times have you said to someone, you okay? Yeah. And you knew they weren't okay. Something wrong? No. And you knew there was something wrong because you felt it. Your frequencies don't lie. So That's how that works with children with autism and trying to recreate the ideal music frequencies that the child might have experienced. And let's say it's a vaccine-damaged child. Then you offer frequencies pre-vaccine injury, and they're getting good results. Can lavender as aromatherapy reduce anxiety in surgery patients? Well, from the Cornell Medical College, the answer is yes. Lavender aromatherapy reduced preoperative anxiety in a study of ambulatory surgery patients undergoing procedures in general surgery. And in the 100-patient study, the experimental group received inhalation lavender aromatherapy in the preoperative waiting area, while the control group received standard nursing care. Now, both groups reported their anxiety with a visual analog scale when arriving to the preoperative waiting area and upon departure in the operating room. And the preoperative anxiety is associated with, of course, increased use of anesthetics and prolonged duration of hospitalization. In other words, just being in a hospital, you're going to be anxious. Knowing you're fighting an infection or you're getting surgery for something, you create enormous anxiety. Well, given the simplicity and the safety and the cost-effectiveness of aromatherapy, healthcare workers should be providing this in every hospital in the United States. And that was the outcome, their conclusion. They published this in a investigative medical publication. For you who have arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis symptoms, and it's progressing, getting worse, according to Kite College in India, there are foods with proven beneficial effects on the progression and symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis. And this was published in Frontiers in Nutrition. And so incorporating these foods into your diet can make a difference. Quote, regular consumption of specific dietary fibers, vegetables, fruits, and spices, as well as the elimination of components that cause inflammation and damage, can help patients to manage the effects of rheumatoid arthritis. And then it goes on to talk about which foods can cause the arthritis pain, the swelling, the stiffness in the joints, and severely impact the quality of life. And, quote, patients suffering from rheumatoid arthritis should switch from a meat-based diet and drinking alcohol and smoking to a Mediterranean vegan diet. How about that? And of course, right up high on the list are meats and processed meats, type Americans love, that can contribute to this. They're looking at blueberries, pomegranates, dried plums, whole grains, ginger, turmeric, coconut oil as anti-inflammatory, turning off, in other words, the cytokines, cyto, C-Y-T-O, kines, K-I-N-E-S. Those are the chemicals released by your immune system that can cause problems in rheumatoid arthritis, and that helps reduce joint stiffness and pain. So that's good information. Now, tomorrow I'm going to give you the 21 calcium deficiency symptoms that, well, will surprise you. How do you know that you're deficient in calcium? I'll tell you about that on tomorrow's program. And also tomorrow I'll talk about how bacteria may help babies' digestive tracts more than we imagine, the good bacteria. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. For all of you who listened last night to a special report on Libya, because this is not a regional radio program, we're broadcast all over the world, and including a lot of Arab nations, I left all the Arabic in. I believe it's important that they understand what happened, if they don't already. But now I'm going to, today we're editing out the Arabic, and for just the American and Canadian or English-speaking audience, and I'm going to play that tomorrow on our local stations, not on Progressive Radio Network, but on our local stations, including our sister station, BAI in New York. And in this, we're adding a lot of stuff from last night that you have not heard. For example, we're going to show you people on the ground in Libya before the NATO bombing, during it, and afterwards. We have one particular clip that you should really focus on because it was the person who helped lead the revolution. And he acknowledges in there that ISIS and al-Nusra and al-Qaeda, they were all being funded and supported and weaponized by Saudi Arabia, United States, Great Britain. In other words, everybody who says they're against terrorism was sponsoring terrorism against the Libyan people. But now that they won, and after Gaddafi's death, now the country has been in chaos. So that is a six-year post the Libya invasion interview where he talks about, man, we wish we had Gaddafi back, wish we had Libya back, because what we have now is just one giant hellhole. It's an interesting thing to hear the person that was one of the lead generals now saying, we got it all wrong. Well, everyone got it wrong. The entire story has been manufactured from the New York Times to CNN and NPR. They all got it wrong. Now, could they have gotten it wrong innocently? Yes. Do I believe they did? Not at all. They have too many resources. This was an agenda-driven regime change. Go for the resources. We don't want Gaddafi interfering in our AFRICOM program to militarize all of Africa and therefore be able to exploit all of its resources in the name of fighting terrorism. But they destroyed Libyans, and they should be held accountable. So a very special, in-depth report tomorrow. You'll hear the people, and we've got a new version that's going to play tomorrow, but it will not be all in Arabic. And people who heard it last night, Progressive Commentary Hour, it's because we have a worldwide audience. So now let's go to consumerism. And I'm not going to play the whole thing. You can go to prn.fm, which stands for PRN, Progressive Radio Network, .com, to watch all of it. But now consumerism, which is causing so many of the problems we have, it causes inequality, causes pollution, causes diminishment of our resources, it causes adverse health, it causes anxiety, it causes overwork. So many things that we never thought are caused by what we do, what we buy. Here's how we got here. Please listen in.
We've struggled over the centuries to dominate the planet. Fascism. Communism. Democracy. Religion. But only one has achieved total supremacy. Its compulsive attractions rob its followers of reason and good sense. It has created unsustainable inequalities that threaten to tear apart the very fabric of our society.
More powerful than any cause or even religion, it has reached into every corner of the globe. It is consumerism. My name's Jonathan Porritt, and for the last three decades I've been banging on about the environment, about social justice, all that kind of stuff. I first got involved back in the 70s with Friends of the Earth and the Green Party. And since then, I've been a campaigner, candidate, I've taken direct action, I've been an advisor to government, to big business, I've written books, I've lectured, I've hectored, I've implored, deplored, you name it, I've done it. For the last 10 years, I've been working with Forum for the Future to promote the solutions to today's social and environmental problems. And I've come to realize that it's consumerism that is absolutely at the heart of this.
But what is consumerism? Isn't it just a posh way to describe shopping? We're all consumers, after all. We all go shopping. And society obviously couldn't function without some level of consumption.
I'm not talking about consumption here. I'm talking about the idea that we should all actively be consuming more and more every year, and that this is the best measure of economic progress. So consumerism puts consumption at the very heart of the modern economy. And everything is done to persuade us to go and consume more. Advertising hoardings, billboards, newspapers, magazines, the TV, we are bombarded day in, day out by these advertising messages. You may think they're all selling you something different, different products, different brands, different lifestyles, but at the same time, they're selling one big idea, that the more we consume, the better our lives will be.
Almost unnoticed, consumerism has become our principal pastime, our zeitgeist, our ideology, all rolled into one. It's a very seductive idea. But it's also a lethal idea. We've become a generation of compulsive shopaholics. Scale up all those individual acts of consumption, multiplied by several billion people, and stand back and watch the disaster unfold.
The trouble is, as consumers, we don't always know the real cost of what we're buying. Now, my daughters have an absolute passion for these Braeburn apples. They're juicy, crunchy, but they're air freighted in from New Zealand. So God knows how much fuel has been spent to get them here into my hometown. What we really ought to be doing is buying far more of the food that we need from local farmers' markets like this. That way, producers linked up with the consumer, environmental impacts are reduced, and we really do begin to understand the true cost of eating the way we eat today.
It may seem ridiculous to link apples from New Zealand to global meltdown, but every little act of consumption is linked to a much bigger picture. Our love of shopping quite literally threatens the end of the world as we know it today. As our population grows and we go on consuming more and more, the ecosystems on which we depend are now close to collapse. Greenhouse gases are higher now than at any time in at least the past 650,000 years. The ice caps are melting. Glaciers are disappearing. Sea levels are rising. It's no longer a debate about if it's happening, but about how quickly and with what impact on our lives. No one will be immune from its effects. And it's all down to the power of modern consumerism. So how did we fall into this trap? For much of human history, the biggest problem was scarcity, experienced as poverty, hunger, deprivation. So this urge to acquire, to go beyond meeting one's basic needs, started as a survival instinct, as part of our essential human nature. As civilization advanced, life got easier. Material goods became more available, but they were never what we consider plentiful, except for a tiny minority. For thousands of years, there were only a comparatively few conspicuous consumers, the rich and the powerful. For them, the trappings of luxury always had a secondary purpose. They were designed to distinguish the rulers from the ruled, to remind the powerless where the power really lay. Society was so rigidly divided that the poor accepted their lot without question, and that was largely due to one very good reason. The fear of God. Most major faiths have historically stressed the importance of the community over the individual, a spiritual virtue over material success. The Quran, for example, encourages Muslims to focus on the spiritual rather than the physical world. Everything that is given to you is only the material of this life and its vanity. What is with God is far better and everlasting. The founding fathers of the Christian Church railed against material consumption too. As the Bible itself says, "Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." Believers today still struggle to follow this teaching. But in the past, when religion was the force in the West, it set the tone for society.
It was the power of the church that reinforced people's willingness to be satisfied with very little. Frugality, not self-interest, was the name of the game. After all, what really mattered was life after death, not a better life here on earth.
But after thousands of years, when wealth and material abundance were either unattainable or frowned upon, everything was about to change. During the 17th century, new trade routes opened up, and a new middle class of traders and entrepreneurs emerged to exploit them. They reveled in their newfound wealth. It now became respectable to consume and to flaunt one's consumption. In 1776, one man would capture this spirit of self-interested individualism. In his book, The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith argued that the pursuit of luxury worked as an economic driver that would make everybody richer. The best way to encourage economic growth is to unleash individuals to pursue their own selfish economic interests, he wrote. Adam Smith provided the model for an economic system which would take over the world. Capitalism was born, and from now on, consumerism would be at the heart of it. During the 19th century, scarcity was gradually overcome. Personal wealth and the trade it promoted drove an unparalleled economic boom that transformed the West. Giant factories were built to provide the goods that society now demanded.
Thanks to the Industrial Revolution, there was a gradual shift towards mass consumerism. Mountains of manufactured goods began to appear, cheap stuff that more and more people could afford. And it felt good, as if the better life was just around the corner.
And it wasn't just the production of goods which was revolutionized. The process of buying was itself transformed. After the first department store opened in 1852, shopping became a respectable leisure activity. Department stores offered a dream world of material luxury, promoting shopping as an experience to savor. And stores became the cathedrals for a new faith on the march. But there was one country in which shopping and consumerism would become a way of life. By the early 20th century, Americans had the highest personal wealth of any country in the world, creating huge new markets. Enterprising business people realized that they could make their fortunes by manufacturing luxury items at prices the American working classes could afford. Henry Ford's assembly line made cars which were previously the preserve of just a privileged few available to all. Many other products were soon to follow. By the 1920s, the ordinary man and woman in America had come to believe that affluence was their birthright. And to have access to consumer wealth became an integral part of the American dream.
It was around this time that consumerism took a very different turn, stimulating and manipulating people's desires, spinning dreams, subtly creating envy. And as the advertising industry really took off, temptation and seduction became at least as important as providing information.
Big business and its advertising agencies turned to the science of psychology. One of the pioneers was Edward Bernays, who had become known as the father of public relations. He was fascinated by the discoveries of Freud and other psychiatrists. He believed that if you understood what motivated people, you could influence their behavior without them knowing about it and cajole them into buying even more. He said, "In almost every act of our daily lives, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind." Advertisers started to work out how to play on our subconscious. It wasn't what the product did that mattered. It was the kind of person it promised to make you feel. Consumerism was now deep inside our heads, exploiting our deepest feelings, our emotions, and even our identities. We were all being trained to desire. But consumerism didn't always go unopposed.
We will continue with the next part of this on tomorrow's show. Now let's go down to Washington, D.C. We're standing by as Robert Perry. I gave you his bio a little earlier in the program. And we're going to talk about the new McCarthyism and the efforts to launch a new Cold War with Russia. Nice to have you back with us, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
There's a significant amount of Russian and Putin bashing appearing in the mainstream media almost daily. And as we're quickly becoming accustomed to, and the lines between fact and fiction get blurred, and it's becoming increasingly difficult for the average American to discern what is real and what is illusionary. And I would add, what makes this situation worse is that people who are intellectuals, people who have an expertise in certain areas, or good critical thinking skills are ignored and denigrated today. Henry Giroux, Chris Hedges, Cornel West speak out about this frequently. So the average person gets their commentary on news from talking heads and pundits who don't know about the details behind a worthy news event or simply people who are morons. But we see from articles printed in the Washington Post and the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and major sources on television like CNN and NBC and MSNBC that all they do is demonize Putin and fear-mongering against Russia. So you have associated this with the rise of a new McCarthyism. So please explain why this is the case and the ultimate short and long-term motives behind it, and who are the actual players for the media's promoting the McCarthyite agenda. The form is yours.
Well, for the past several years, there's been this effort to generate a new Cold War with Russia. And there are a lot of people that have reason for that. It's not these things don't just pop up out of the blue. And this is not to say that there haven't been things that Russia or its leader, Vladimir Putin, have done that don't deserve criticism. But what we've seen is a wildly overstated case against Russia. And that makes sense for the military-industrial complex, for instance, because, frankly, the war on terror, which was able to sort of generate income after the end of the first Cold War, was petering out a bit because they weren't the big-ticket items. They weren't the big strategic weapon systems that really make money. So you had that interest in Washington, which is very powerful. Remember what President Eisenhower warned us about. So you had that. You had the neoconservatives who dominate Washington's foreign policy. They have now for a number of years, both under Republicans and Democrats. They were certainly very strong under President George W. Bush. They helped get us into the Iraq War. They've also been remain fairly strong during the Obama years. They sort of changed a bit. They went more with a sort of a humanitarian argument for intervention, but the policies were pretty much indistinguishable. And many key neoconservatives remained there under Obama. For instance, the Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, Victoria Nuland, who was part of the Kagan neocon family. She was married to Robert Kagan. And so she was a big promoter of going after Russia, trying to expand NATO up to Russia's borders, organizing protests and a coup d'etat in Ukraine in 2014, which really set off in a big way the new Cold War. So you had a number of people with various interests here. And demonizing foreign enemies has always been a sort of a easy way to make a political hay. We've seen that, of course, throughout history. So you had these various factors coming in, and then you had the Democrats losing shockingly to Donald Trump a year ago in 2016. And instead of the Democrats looking at what really happened and how they really lost that election, and there were a number of reasons, primarily the Democrats had lost touch with the white working class. They had treated them with disrespect. Hillary Clinton, their Democratic nominee, had called half of Trump's voters deplorables, which was read by many of the people in that voting bloc as an insult to them and their friends. There was the fact that Hillary Clinton was perceived as almost the epitome of that, of what's corrupt about Washington, the using your public service to make tons of money. After she left Secretary of the State job, even as she was planning to run for president, she went off and made millions of dollars giving speeches to special interests, including Wall Street. So you had a lot of reasons why Hillary Clinton did so badly in some of these working class areas. But instead of facing up to that reality and the other problems that the Democratic Party has been dealing with, identity politics, failure to really enunciate a clear set of principles in many ways, it became easy for them to say, well, Russia became the reason why Hillary Clinton lost. And if you remember, it was actually Hillary Clinton herself initially blamed her defeat on FBI Director James Comey for first closing the investigation into her private email server and then reopening it 11 days before the election and then closing it again. And that did obviously hurt her. It reminded many Americans of why they didn't trust her, and her poll numbers suffered as a result. So you had a lot of reasons that had nothing to do with Russia at all. The Russians didn't tell Hillary Clinton to set up a private server as Secretary of State, nor did they tell the FBI director what to do. So there was this effort to sort of make the Russians the scapegoats instead of the Democrats facing their problems. And there was also the fury that many people felt about Donald Trump becoming president. Anything that could be used to get rid of him, any way to wipe him out, get him impeached, force him to resign, was considered a useful approach. And you had what was called the resistance to Trump, which took shape very quickly after he became president. And many Democrats saw the Russiagate scandal as the way to carry that out, to get Trump. So we had a lot of reasons why this wildly exaggerated case against Russia was being pushed by the mainstream press. The New York Times and the Washington Post pretty openly became part of the resistance to Trump. And that's not to defend Trump. I mean, I'm just saying that this is how it was working. Instead of people looking at the reality of what happened in 2016, the idea was for a lot of people's interests to find this new boogeyman, actually the old boogeyman in a sense, the Russians. So off we went. And the Democrats can't seem to get off of it. It's become something that they focus on. And we're now seeing the goalposts keep getting moved. The original idea was that somehow the Trump people had collaborated or colluded with the Russians about getting the emails from the DNC and from Clinton's campaign chairman John Podesta, and then somehow got them to WikiLeaks. Now, that has not really turned out to be true. The evidence has not been there, and there's actually serious doubts about whether the Russians were responsible for the so-called hacking to begin with. There are arguments that it was actually a leak that came out of more traditional methods of taking information. But the idea that the Trump people then colluded in that endeavor has not been supported by the evidence. So it's been now moved to, did any of the Trump people talk to Russians? And now we're seeing that playing out. If you talk to a Russian, somehow that was terrible. So this has become something very McCarthyistic, both in terms of how it's being aimed, this guilt by association being aimed at some of the Trump volunteers and people who are on their advisory boards, but also now it's becoming a way to go after independent news media, which was getting more traction on the internet. The New York Times, the Washington Post, and the mainstream media has felt undermined by the fact that Americans are getting information more from more diverse sources than just the so-called gatekeepers of the past. So the old gatekeepers want to sort of shut that gate, and so they're using now this hysteria about Russia to justify and put and indeed you're seeing members of Congress now pressuring the Twitter people, the folks at Facebook, the folks at Google and elsewhere to impose mainstream rules and in terms of what the mainstream deems true on the internet and find ways to either have pop-ups to warn readers that this story is false because it's been determined to be false by some of these mainstream people, or to have certain websites not show up when you do a search on Google, or punish people by preventing them from getting ads if that's how they're making money to keep their websites going. So there's all these new methods to essentially shut down some of the most serious, some of the most effective independent news sites, and it assumes that the mainstream press always gets it right, which we all know is not true. The mainstream press has gotten major stories, really important stories that have led to massive loss of life, like the Iraq War, wrong. So, but instead of allowing that to go on, we're going to have this new idea that we're going to have all these ways of suppressing this independent media. And one quick example of how insidious this can be is that you have a group called PolitiFact, which is considered one of the premier fact-checking organizations. And last year, they decided that when Hillary Clinton said a falsehood, that there were 17 U.S. intelligence agencies, all of them investigated and signed off on this idea that the Russians were behind these release of these emails. That was never true. Those of us who cover, I've covered intelligence really going back to the 1980s. What that would have been a reference to was a national intelligence estimate, which does consult with 17 intelligence agencies and gets a consensus and prints and dissents and so forth. That never happened here. And we know that for instance, that when the January 6th report came out, it was not done by all 17 agencies. It was done by, and this is the phrase that the Director of National Intelligence, Clapper, used, hand-picked analysts from three agencies, CIA, the NSA, and the FBI. And they put them in a room, and these hand-picked analysts came up with the outcome that was desired by their political superiors, then still in the Obama administration. So you had basically stovepiped intelligence, similar to what we had in before the Iraq War on WMD, on this. Now, maybe they're right, but I've talked to serious people in the intelligence community who have grave doubts that those handpicked analysts got it right. And if you read the January 6th report, it doesn't even say that this is a fact. They say it's their assessment, it's their best guess, in other words, that the Russians were behind it. But so we have this other problem, though, where PolitiFact has continued to insist that its determination that these 17 intelligence agencies were all doing proving this is still true. And after Clapper's testimony, where he acknowledged that it wasn't true, and after CIA Director John Brennan had similar testimony under oath before Congress, I was writing stories saying this shows that this wasn't true. And the New York Times was finally forced to run a correction, and the Associated Press ran a correction. But PolitiFact, which is going to be one of these groups, which is on this so-called first draft coalition, which has already been set up to decide what's going to be considered true and what's not going to be considered true, is still insisting that this falsehood is true. They don't want to admit they got it wrong. And that gets back to this point of how crazy we've gotten in this new Cold War, this new McCarthyism, that we're going to have, and it's even more almost Orwellian, that you have these groups that are certainly far from perfect. They have a really checkered history of getting facts wrong. They're going to be deciding what's true and what Americans are going to be allowed to read and how they're going to, what they'll see, how they'll see it, if they'll be able to see it. And that's a big change in America. We've even had cases where very serious, a serious documentary on the so-called Magnitsky case, which is another early part of the new Cold War, was this claim that there was a whistleblowing lawyer who found some corruption and then was thrown in prison for it and died in jail. A guy named Magnitsky, and a law was passed in 2012 called the Magnitsky Act, which imposed sanctions on Russia. Now, the story that about Magnitsky was essentially a fantasy, and there was a very good documentary done a year or two ago, which actually started out to write this, do a documentary that would be favorable to the Magnitsky's legend. But then in the midst of it, the documentarian realized he was being lied to and misled, and the documents went in a different direction. And it turned out that Magnitsky was not a lawyer. He was an accountant who was involved in the scam that the myth said he had exposed. So what happens to that documentary? It was supposed to be shown in Brussels at the European Parliament. And at the last minute, the European parliamentarians pulled the plug, said, we can't see this. It was allowed to be shown once at the museum in Washington, but pretty much after that, it has been Americans can't get to see this documentary. It's almost like and the Washington Post and the New York Times and others have taken some pride in the fact that this documentary has been suppressed because they deem it Russian propaganda. So instead of the American people as the sovereigns of this nation, we the people, being given all the information possible so the American people can make the best decisions possible, we're now being told, no, that's not going to be the way it's going to work anymore, guys. You're going to get what is deemed acceptable, and then the rest of the stuff gets suppressed.
Robert, to make a fine point of that, a year ago I was asked by Bonnie Faulkner, you know Bonnie, of Buns and Gutter, Guns and Butter, and she was on KPFA in Berkeley. She said, Gary, would you come on and talk about the science behind vaccines being mandatory in California because it's up for a vote and it's very close? I said, sure. I've written with Richard Gale about 42 articles on the politics of vaccines, and they've been published in respected places, and they're all completely referenced and footnoted. And just before we were supposed to do the show, she was said they canceled it. They censored her. Why? Because they, the people at KPFA, one of the Pacifica stations, did not want that information. They engaged in censorship, a form of McCarthyism, but it went further. Not only did they not want this information to get out, for whatever their motives, but their excuse was that I do not believe in AIDS. Now, that's rather funny, considering that for 15 years, I personally worked with 1,200 persons with AIDS. I saw that they got their medical treatment, holistic medical treatment, and my dime, I paid for it, they didn't. Your final thoughts, please.
Well, I mean, there is a situation that we sort of grew up in as a nation. The Enlightenment was this period where the idea was that the best way to achieve good governance and good policies is to have the ideas, various ideas, debated, and the best ones supposedly would prevail, or at least have a better chance of prevailing, because the public would have a lot of knowledge, and that was the ideal. Now, obviously, you're going to run across people that do make fake stories. That has happened. As a journalist, I hate that. There are sometimes you'll see totally lunatic conspiracy theories that are dreamt up without any facts behind them. I hate that too. But there are serious issues that need to be aired with the American people, and this idea that we shouldn't have people who know what they're talking about, who are raising very valid, serious questions that they've come across because of their research and evidence that they've uncovered, real evidence, that should be withheld from the American people. And this is sort of a new paradigm that we're now seeing in this new phase of journalism, that people take pride. People in journalism take pride in suppressing serious other points of view, because I guess in this case, in the case we've been talking about with the Democrats, is that the hatred of Trump is so intense, that Trump is such a threat, as they would put it, that that we have to suppress any views, any evidence that doesn't support the narrative that he's somehow controlled by Vladimir Putin and was simply put into power by the Kremlin. As crazy as that really is, as an argument, when you look at all the things that happened during the 2016 election, and the fact that not even the intelligence community has said they have factual evidence to support this claim that the Russians did it, they call this an assessment. And they say in that assessment on January 6th that they say that we are not saying this is a fact. We are not claiming we have proven this. We are saying this is our assessment, which is sort of their best guess. But in a situation like that where there's no evidence that's being brought forward by the U.S. intelligence community, and we have counter evidence coming from some people who were senior people in that intelligence community, people like William Binney of the NSA, we're not allowed to talk about it. And if it does somehow pop up, it's ridiculed and denounced and made into sort of a joke. So what we're seeing is something very, very troubling in terms of democracy, in terms of how the press is functioning. And I think it's something that we're now, it's becoming worse and worse. Anyone who has appeared on RT, which is actually a fairly credible news organization, they do some very good work, but they're now deemed Russian propaganda. So anyone who's even appeared on them, Larry King is, by the way, on there, and Ed Schultz. But it's all become something we have to reject. And this is not the way that a healthy democracy functions.
No, and they've gone after Abby Martin, Glenn Greenwald. So we should pay attention. You're right. And by the way, you mentioned Benny. He will appear this afternoon at 5 p.m. With Les Jamieson to talk about whistleblowing in America, following up on what you've said. So I want to thank you very much for being on today. And I also want to commend the brave independent producers within any radio or television or print media who, irrespective of what the owners of the organizations may believe, you're still having the courage to look for the truth, find it, and get it out to the people. I commend you for that. And Robert, as always, thank you very much for being on, and continue with your outstanding reporting.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.